Welcome to Careers in Your Ears, the careers podcast for research staff and students at King's College London. I'm Donald Lush, one of the specialist researcher careers advisors here at King's. And today I'm joined by Rebecca Buxton and Lisa Whiting, who have recently edited and published a book called The Philosopher Queens, all about women philosophers and their work. So welcome, Rebecca and Lisa. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having us. Real pleasure to be back at King's virtually.
That's good to hear. No, thank you so much. I know how busy you are. So can I just start by asking you to introduce yourselves briefly? So what are you doing at the moment and kind of how did you get there? What led up to what you're doing right now? Lisa, do you want to go first?
Yeah, definitely. I'll kick off. So in terms of my kind of career and my professional background, I guess I'll start with kind of university. So for my undergraduate degree, I went to Durham and studied philosophy. And I really, really enjoyed my subject. I really enjoyed academia. But once I finished my undergraduate degree, I think I faced a bit of a crossroads and I wasn't sure whether I wanted to stay in academia, continue with research, or whether I wanted to try and get a job kind of working on similar issues that I found kind of intellectually interesting, but a bit closer to the action in the policy sphere. So that's something that a choice that I had to make. And in the end, I decided to try and do both, essentially. So I started working as a policy professional at a regulator, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. And as part of that work, I was wrestling with quite a lot of the policy questions around kind of biomedical ethics and a lot of the topics that I studied at in my undergrad, but try and apply it to a bit more of a policy lens. And since then, I have done a few different policy jobs, all centred around themes around ethics and inequality. But also whilst working, I've also been studying a master's part-time. So in the end, I didn't really pick between the two. I tried to do both of them.
You've done both. Rebecca, how about you?
Yeah, so I also did philosophy for my undergrad at King's, and I had a very similar experience to Lisa. I really enjoyed the subject while I was doing it, but I did feel a slight apathy with whether or not I was doing anything sort of useful in the world, which I think is a bit of a theme with philosophy degrees. There was a joke I heard yesterday, which was like, what's the difference between a philosophy degree and a pizza? A pizza can feed a family of four. and I was sort of worried about whether or not I'd be able to do anything with my degree. And while I was at King's, I was actually the president of Student Action for Refugees, and I became really involved in a few like local organisations. And it was 2015 when I was there, so it was sort of the peak of the Syrian refugee crisis. So that led me to pursue a master's degree at Oxford in Refugee and Forced Migration Studies. And one of the head professors there just happens to be a political philosopher who I was really excited to work with. And so I did my dissertation on climate, refugees and reparative justice. And then when I left, I was hoping that I would sort of go straight into some really engaged policy humanitarian work. And I really struggled to find a job when I'd finished my master's. And I must have applied for 30 or 40 roles, and I only ended up getting an interview for one, and it was working for an MP at the House of Commons, so it's a pretty good job. But it was an MP that I didn't totally agree with most of his views, but it was a really fantastic place to work. So I worked there for about a year and a half, and while I was there, I decided I wanted to go back to Oxford to do my PhD. And that's where I am now. So I'm in my third year. I'm just about finished writing the first full draft of my PhD. Right. And I've sort of dived headfirst back into just doing philosophy. So I do work in, still work in the same interdisciplinary department. So my work is on political philosophy about migration and refugees. So I've sort of done the same as Lisa. We've combined, gone for both rather than just one.
Right. So to both of you, has this always been your plan, or is it sort of evolved? It sounds like it's evolved as circumstances have changed around you. Is that fair? Lisa, what do you think?
Yeah, I would definitely say that's fair. I think for both of us, when we were at college, we didn't really have a kind of profession or a career in mind when we were picking what to study at university. And that is definitely something that worried me a little bit. I thought, maybe I should study law or something that felt like it more directly led into a profession. But I was quite fortunate that my parents were quite supportive, and they were very much of the view, which is like, if you're going to study for something for 3 years, it might as well be something that you love and are passionate about, and just try and do that to the best of your ability. And I definitely had points in my undergraduate degree where I really more seriously considered whether I'd want to stay in academia, but I definitely didn't have a proper plan. And it was actually only really through work that I did at university as part of kind of the students' union and becoming more interested in politics that really led me to that career. Because I think there are a lot of jobs that obviously exist that people don't even know about when they're kind of applying to university. Yeah. And policy was something I didn't really understand. I didn't really know what it involved. So it was only really through building up those networks at university that I began to understand what those options might look like. So I definitely say it's, for me at least, it's been much more of an iterative process. Yeah. And just seeing where my career has taken me.
I think that's how it usually works. How about you, Rebecca? Is it a long-term plan, or has it sort of been a bit of luck and opportunity seeking?
Yeah, lots of luck, I think. I had the same experience as Lisa. Like, I was very lucky that we both just decided to do a subject that we loved. And we were quite soon, we went to university quite soon after the tuition fee rise. So I felt like, if I'm going to be paying all this money for university, I think you can go one of two ways. You can say, if I'm going to pay all this money, I better make it something that's going to give me a career, or I better make it something that I love. And I think we both went the second way, which I think was right for us at the time. But yeah, I mean, the master's was, I was trying to go into a different career then. I was trying to escape philosophy and go and do something sort of really hands-on. And it just didn't really work out for me. And I'm happy that it didn't, because it means I've got to come back here and do my PhD. And now I'm very much, I'm attempting to develop a career in academia. I'm doing postdoc applications at the moment, which anybody who's done them sort of knows how horrible they are. So
yes, lots of people listening will feel your pain.
Yeah, to hear the pain in my voice.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, great. So, you know, lots of happenstance, really. So let's talk about the book. Let's talk about Philosopher Queens. And would you like to introduce it to the audience? Rebecca, would you like to kick off?
Yeah, sure. So the book sort of started with Lisa going into Waterstones on a day off to try and find a book on women philosophers.
Yeah.
She couldn't find one. But she did find two books, or several books, I think, called something like The Greatest Philosophers. And there's one in particular with that title that entirely, each chapter is about a man philosopher. Right. And each chapter is written by a man, and it's edited by two men. Mm. So she took a picture of it, tweeted about it, I think, and said, I'm going to write a book about women philosophers, entirely written by women. And we were living together at the time, and then we sort of just did it. I mean, I think I'm a bit boisterous in that if a good idea comes up, I'm quite keen to at least give it a go. And I had a friend who worked in publishing, and he gave us some advice on where to pitch it. Mm. And now it exists. So it's called The Philosopher Queens, and it's 20 chapters about 20 different women throughout the history of philosophy, and each chapter is written by a woman in philosophy now, and it's edited by myself and Lisa. So it's the exact antithesis of the book that Lisa found a few years ago.
We were talking before we started recording this, and I had exactly the same experience. I went looking for that book that you've created that didn't exist. The reason I've bought it and I'm reading it now is exactly the things you've talked about. Lisa, did you want to add anything about the kind of the book, the journey?
No, just to reiterate what Rebecca said, that I felt like it was a real team effort. I think it really was kind of down to her that we actually kind of pursued it, because I think that we had a lot of doubt about, like, we were quite young at the time. We'd obviously only studied philosophy for a few years, and we kind of came up with all these reasons why maybe we shouldn't. But as you said, we felt really strongly it was a book that should exist, and were quite confused that it hadn't existed. And we were like, well, if no one else is going to do it, then why don't we? And I'm really, really glad that we did.
Yeah, the question, why doesn't it exist? I can remember you know, the emotional shock of that, going through that wonderful section in Waterstones. Yeah, that's just, it was amazing. So, I mean, you've, as you've mentioned, it's, you know, it's really striking how histories of philosophy and philosophers are usually about men. I mean, I think my first introduction was Russell's History of Western Philosophy. I don't think there are any women in that book. And academia is like that as well. So 75% of professors in the UK are white men. So this might be a difficult question, but what advice, if any, would you give to a woman PhD student or a master's student or an early career researcher thinking about approaching an academic career, given that the odds seem to look stacked against women?
Yeah, I guess my advice would be, you know, those networks don't really exist. So you have to work really hard to create networks for yourself. And there are always other people at university with you going through the same experience. And so making sure that you have a support system in place, people that you can go talk to about any problems that you have. Or, I mean, I have several WhatsApp groups with teams of women PhD students where we just share advice with each other, which is always really useful. But I'd also say, like, a lot of what I've experienced as a PhD student is really just lacking any kind of confidence that I'm good enough to be doing this. And so I think it's really about making sure that you don't second guess yourself constantly about whether you can have a career in academia, especially philosophy, where all of the dominant images that we have of philosophers are men. It can really feel like you're not meant to be there, but you definitely are. And you just need to find the people who are going to be supportive of you in the best way possible.
Great. So all about networking. Lisa, did you want to add anything to that? What else do you think people might think about?
It's a really good question. I think Rebecca's probably a better place to advise because she's kind of in the midst of it at the moment. Sure. But I would definitely kind of second what she said around that feeling that kind of you're maybe not good enough because you don't reflect the kind of images that we see. And I think what we're beginning to see at the moment with books like ours, and actually a range of new books that have recently been published around kind of women philosophers or underrepresented groups and people in the history of philosophy, is to not be afraid to kind of challenge the prevailing notions around kind of what counts as philosophy, who counts as being a philosopher. And actually that could be some of the most fruitful areas of research over the next couple of years, is kind of trying to really grapple with kind of modern problems and modern issues and not feeling like you have to model yourself and your work on what's kind of come before. But like I say, that's hard when it feels like that there's a certain kind of dominant worldview that you kind of have to fit yourself into to succeed.
But isn't it ironic that that's the essence of philosophy? It's like questioning received wisdom is what you do. So
exactly. Yeah.
And it's made so hard to do that. I mean, those are two great bits of advice. So you know, ask the hard questions, think you belong, you know, network, team up with other people. I think those are really great tips. And Lisa, I wanted to particularly ask you, so you work outside academia. I think you work at Birkbeck, don't you?
No, so I'm studying at Birkbeck at the moment, but currently I work in policy.
Yeah, so is it more equal in your work? And if it is, what makes the difference? What is different?
Oh, that's a really tricky question, because I've worked in a few different areas. I've worked previously in kind of more biomedical ethics, and then briefly for a time in more kind of data ethics. And I think with any area of society, I think there are challenges. And I think particularly the areas that I work in are still often quite intellectual, in the sense that there are kind of ongoing big debates, and there's actually a relatively close relationship between academia and policy in a lot of the areas that I work in. So I actually don't know if there's too much separation. I think one of the things that I think I've heard quite a lot of people who potentially have transitioned from academia to policy is that it can provide a sense of stability. So the kind of practical consequences of working, obviously academia has a huge amount of challenges in terms of kind of the job market security, things like childcare, like security in terms of location. So I think that's one thing that potentially kind of non-academic jobs can provide, is a little bit more sense of kind of job security, but that's much more on the kind of practical side of things. In terms of the kind of ongoing ways in which we like value people and kind of prioritize certain kind of ideas and theories, I think they're all kind of be slightly similar challenges.
Okay, so some, and that kind of leads me to my next thought, really, which is I wanted to ask Rebecca, currently heading for an academic career, what are your thoughts on how things need to change? And I mean, I'm thinking kind of institutionally, you know, Lisa mentioned just there about how people value things, how things are done in institutions needs to change. I mean, what particularly do you think needs to take place in academia so that, you know, philosophy departments are much more representative?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because so at undergraduate level, philosophy, women make up about half of philosophy students. So the drop off really happens between undergraduate and graduate study, which in sort of my particular area of expertise, which is like political philosophy, that has definitely been the case. So there are lots of women who work on migration in particular, but easily 75 to 80% of the people that I work with are men. So I think a lot of it comes around representation. So I only had one woman philosophy lecturer in my undergraduate degree, and she happened to be a mentor for me. She worked on immigration at King's, Sarah Fine, and that was really important to me. And so many women in my undergraduate didn't get that because she was the only one who was available. So I think that kind of encouragement is so important, but that can only happen if there are more women represented in departments to begin with. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem in lots of ways. To be honest, I think departments just have to make a much more explicit effort with who they're hiring, and to reduce barriers to certain sets of people being able to continue into academia. So many people who work in academia or who are doing PhDs, for instance, have parents who are professors, which I was so shocked by when I started doing my PhD, because they had access to this whole language of the university that I knew nothing about.
Yeah.
So it's making sure that people have access to the same sort of systems of knowledge, that people know how to publish. Like some institutions don't really give you that, they expect you to know all of it, and that really disproportionately affects people who aren't already embedded in those institutions, who tend to be people who are less privileged. I do think that departments are starting to make a change. So even just from my job application, where I get emailed like philosophy jobs that are being advertised, and there are more and more that are on sort of decolonial philosophy, women philosophers. So places are starting to try to hire people from diverse sets of backgrounds, which is really encouraging. So I think it's a mixture of everything, basically. How do you get rid of sexism anywhere?
Absolutely. I mean, something we talk about in the career service, one of the things we're focusing on is the pipeline in, you know, it's if people aren't there, we can't support them. So we're needing to be encouraging them to think of themselves as future academic philosophers and to apply and to actually go for it. I want to return to the book project. So a very practical way. I mean, you're both ridiculously busy. I mean, I noticed, you know, on your Twitter account, particularly Rebecca, you know, you tell us what you're doing. We know how much you've got to do at the moment. Yet you've managed to edit, partly write, publish and promote a really successful book and a much needed one. So how on earth did you manage your time to make this happen? You know, I know there will be people listening thinking, I'm doing a degree here, I'm doing research, I'm trying to live and eat, you know, and you're now expecting me to write and publish a book as well. You know? So any tips for people who are far too busy to get things done?
Yeah, we were very lucky with the book in that it is mostly written by other people. Get somebody else to do it. Although editing a book is of course a lot of work, but a lot of the book project was collaborative, which was really important for us. Unfortunately for me, I mean, working in academia, anybody who's doing a PhD knows that you don't just do like a 40-hour week. You really have to just work until it's over, and it's never over. So I think I already sort of had that kind of attitude. And at the same time, Lisa, like I was living with Lisa when we started doing the book, and I was working for an MP who I I did work sort of 12-hour days, weekends. Like, I was used to what can be considered a very toxic work environment.
Right.
But it meant that I think I just have a lot more stamina than some people, and that's not necessarily a good thing, because I think it does come from this environment of being encouraged to work until you drop, which occasionally we do. But I don't really know how we did it, Lisa.
No, it's a really good question. I think one thing I would say is, like, Rebecca was obviously a huge help. I think the fact that, I think particularly in the latter stages, because I was kind of doing a 9-to-5 job, there were things that would crop up kind of during the day that I just wasn't really able to do. And Rebecca was amazing and just kind of picking things up where I wasn't able to. And I think there's no way realistically I would have been able to do it by myself. I think the other answer is also to say that it was really hard. Like, we definitely are not going to pretend that it was really easy all the time and that we didn't have to make sacrifices, because I definitely know that there were times where I kind of wasn't able to kind of see my friends as much as I'd wanted to, or I kind of, like, had to cut back on hobbies. And in hindsight, I wouldn't have probably planned to do a part-time master's at the same time as just trying to do the book. But I also was very lucky that I had very supportive employers that allowed me to do things like take study leave, but Beck have been really supportive in helping me to kind of navigate different, like, deadlines based on all these different things. So definitely a combination of kind of grit and luck and very supportive friends and family.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just listening to the two of you talk, I think the fact that you're a team must have helped.
Helped.
Don't try and go it alone too much. I mean, that's something I often say to people when I'm trying to help them. Okay, so final question, to wrap up. One of the things I was kind of very struck by was, you know, the book is out now, and I have this sort of fear that in, you know, 50 years time, somebody will discover a secondhand copy of it in the bookshop and say, well, whatever happened to this? Why did this vanish? Why were we never heard of again? So how do we stop the women philosophers disappearing again? How can people support equality and inclusion in philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I don't really know the answer to it.
Right,
because,
fair enough.
So in part, so there is a book on women philosophers that was published in the 90s by Mary Warnock called Women Philosophers. And in a sense, it's not really a general audience book because it's an anthology. But sort of partway through the process of looking stuff up for the book, we found it. We went, oh, look, there is a book. And isn't it awful that it's just been, it's out of print now. I've managed to find a copy, but it was really expensive.
Yeah.
So it's happened before. I think a lot of it is trying really hard to integrate women into the core curriculum, as opposed to there being basically siloed into the women corner, which maybe we haven't particularly helped with. But I think often our experience of women when they're included on reading this, and this goes for sort of people of colour, queer theorists, and everyone really, they get siloed into a particular week or a particular course, and they're not really thought of as part of the central central discipline. So I think that kind of integration is really important. But no, I guess you just have to hope that people won't forget.
And I guess all you can try is, you know, keep getting things on the record and keep getting them exposure. So we're just about to wrap up. I mean, thank you so much for doing this. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And thanks for sparing the time out of your busy schedules, because I know how busy you are. So join us next time on Careers in Your Ears, when we'll be continuing our explanation of researcher careers.